I'm going to tether myself behind the microphone just for a change. So I said that you bring me in first thing in the morning to talk about safety. And this is arguably one of the more depressing presentations I do. Before we get too excited, I do want to take a moment because 23 years today, at this time, five broadcast engineers realized they weren't going home. Now, the reason I bring that up, they didn't have any control over that. We do. And that's the purpose of this topic, because we need to start making this something you think about in everything you do. Give you an example, at the exhibit hall in the back, they've got a mat over some cables on the floor. And I've tripped on that mat twice, so it could be improved a little. And you just take the mental notes wherever you go in everything you do. The reason for this is because we're stretched thinner today than we've ever been stretched before. How many people have more people working for them than they did 20 years ago or 10 years ago even? Anybody? Nobody wants to admit to it if they do, because you know you'll be the guy everybody's applying to at that point. And how many people are, well, nobody's younger than they were 10 years ago. But it's a challenge, and I've got a few walls of text to run through and set up the background so you can ignore most of it. The text is there so you don't have to look at me, especially this early in the morning. But the average age of the broadcast engineer as a whole is going up, okay? And I mean, that's something that we try to avoid. In most industries, average age stays pretty constant. Depending on the industry, it may go down a little. But if it continues to go up like this, then, life cycles say that it's going to continue to get thinner and thinner. So as a reference, John Poré did a presentation at the SBE when he was executive director back in 2012, talking about the average age of the broadcast engineer. The first two graphs are from his paper. The third one is data I culled from the salary survey this year. Okay, so this is current data, and it's pretty accurate. You know, I mean, assuming that we've got a pretty good demographic as SBE members. How many SBE members in the room? Awesome. So as you look at it, you can see that, you know, in 2001, your average age was in the 35 to 55 range by a long shot. By 2011, you were into the 45 by 65, and now we're seeing 55 to 65 plus. And I mean, that's not an insignificant change. And if that doesn't scare you, this is something, and I've done this presentation for station manager groups, and they'll look at me and they'll go, wow, we had no idea. And it's like, yeah, you need to find a way to bring the young people in. You know, what do they say? Got to bring the sexy back to radio or something. But it's going to be a problem. The challenge is, and I'm looking at this less as a what's the future of broadcast engineering, and more as we got a bunch of tired old guys, girls working around transmitter sites, and it's getting harder. And it's, like I said, safety is going to be more critical. Mr. Persons might recognize this picture. This is the WCCO transmitter control point taken from a whole bunch of years ago. That picture came from Mark Durenberger, another Mark. But how many people have manned transmitter facilities now? Not too many. I mean, it's not nearly as common as it was a bunch of years ago. You know, it used to be you had a broadcast facility, you'd have a transmitter engineer or two or three at a staffed site. You'd have production engineers, you'd have audio engineers. There'd be an engineer for every task. Now it's one engineer for how many stations? You know, and that's the challenge. We're stretched thinner. Now, part of that's our fault. Equipment is, quote, unquote, I'm putting the quotation marks here, you see the air quotes, more reliable. Okay? Equipment is not more reliable. Electronics is electronics. Current goes through something, current will eventually stop going through something. The only difference is now, instead of a plate blocker failing or a tube socket failing and taking you off the air till you can get it fixed, you lose a power supply and you get a red light. Power goes down a little, but not off. so the off-air time is reduced. The challenge to that is that means that the GM sitting back in the studio is like, what's the panic? We're still on the air. How many people have tried to do a software update right before a long weekend? So I'll give you an example. My teenager runs a gaming, an industrial-sized gaming laptop, runs a Minecraft server on it, and that thing works hard and runs hot. And he's got a bearing going in a fan. And so he went to me and he goes, I need some new fans. I said, okay, well, look them up. So we tore the laptop apart so we could get the part numbers, and he found replacements. He ordered them for and got them in. They arrived the day before I was due to fly out to Georgia last week. He goes, can we do these fans? And I said, oh, hell no. And I said, you need to understand something. I said, if I do these fans, and if one of them happens to be bad out of the box, and if one of the other ones goes sideways in the process of shutting it down and taking it out, you're without a computer for a week and a half or 2 weeks. Oh, never thought of that. Yeah, exactly. So that's something we need to think about too, is that scheduling is important. You can do this stuff during the day. And again, it makes it feel like it's less critical. It takes away the sense of urgency. But it's still a red light and it's still got to get fixed, because that's our job, is making the red lights green, right? The other challenge is that a lot of this stuff is modular. And I say challenge, it's a good thing, bad thing, because you can call the station manager and say, hey, what light's red? Okay, well, flip the switch on that module, yank it out, and we'll get a new module on the way. You can slam it in, turn it on. Life is grand. If you have an AM ATU failure, are you going to try and walk a station manager through it? If you've got a tube transmitter, you're going to try and walk somebody through setting the equalization on a Continental tube transmitter. You're reaching in over the mains power supply. You're not going to do that. Was that Alan? Yeah, that's true. If you don't like them very much, maybe, hey, could you give me a hand with this? There's still a lot of high voltage, and we're still connected to AC power, and those are things that need to be taken into account. Okay, I already covered the redundancy. We're not going to beat the drum on that too much. Is Mark still in the room? Mark's still in the room. So this is from an article that Mark wrote for Radio World 12 years ago. We get a lot of calls, and to give you an idea how much of an issue it is, I've started teaching courses on Ohm's Law as part of engineering training, because it is still, how many people use indirect power for figuring, calculating transmitter power? So you're already using Ohm's Law every time you do that. E equals I times R times efficiency, okay, or P equals IV times efficiency in this case. But it's something that's important. Soldering skills. In Columbus next month, I'm doing a co-presentation with Burley Staples of the OAB on solder skills, because it's something we've gotten away from. As we get into the surface mount stuff, we do a lot less soldering. But it's still an important skill to have, because there are times when it's going to be necessary to solder this into that for whatever reason. And this one, I can't stress this one enough. If you do the maintenance, you put out a lot fewer fires. And I can't tell you how many times we don't have time to do the maintenance. We don't have the budget to do the maintenance. But you've always got time to go back there when the flames are coming out, because you don't have a choice at that point. And I tell people, use the analogy, if you got a GM that resists you going out to the site to do scheduled maintenance, use the oil change analogy. You know, you tend to get the oil changed in your car before the engine seizes. Well, you tend to vacuum the bugs out of the air filters at the transmitter before it overheats and shuts down. Okay, and this comes back to the whole talk manager thing, and anybody who's been here before has heard me beat this drum as well. but we run into too many situations where we just show up, do stuff, and leave, and nobody tells management. So management has no idea what y'all are doing. You need to be reporting, okay, and documenting, but that's a whole different discussion that we may get into later. But so make yourself part of the management team. The way you do that is do a weekly report. This is what we did to save the station money this week. This is where we invested funds to lower costs, et cetera, and so on. Phrase it in dollars and cents, because managers don't speak ohms and amps and watts at all, most of them. Some do. If every now and again, you get lucky. But the more maintenance you do, typically, the fewer emergencies you'll have. Fewer doesn't mean none, don't get me wrong. Stuff's still going to go sideways, typically at the worst possible time, usually at about 3 a.m. right before morning drive on a holiday weekend. But that's, yeah. And this is where we get into the real downer part. This was a collection of headlines that I found with a Google search, and the phrase I searched was engineer found dead. I picked three that I knew. There were a lot more hits than that. Now, of those three, only one of them died of electrocution by reaching in this case, to a grounded grid transmitter. That was the guy in Mississippi. Transmitter that he had been working on for 25 years. He knew that transmitter inside out, upside down, and backwards. One day, he hit the wrong thing. Nobody will never know why or how or what. I had a guy on the phone with me one day. He's working on a transmitter, and he was religious about using the grounding stick on everything. Old BTA5, sorry, old RCA. He shut it down. He had the grounding stick. He had the AC off. There was a wire broken in a crimp lug, so he grounded the capacitor, but when he grabbed the lug, discovered there was 5,000 volts on that wire, and it got his attention in a very, very elaborate way. There was I learned words I'd never heard before that day, and I grew up on a farm. I thought I'd heard all the words. Okay, so of those three, only one of them died of electrocution. One of them had a heart attack at the site. Nobody was there. Nobody knew. They found him 3 days later when he didn't show up at the studio on Monday. Okay, you need to have, and this is why the title is Working Alone When We Shouldn't, even though we shouldn't. I tell people, if you can bring somebody else with you, do it. Doesn't have to be another engineer. It could be a GM, could be a PD, could be your girlfriend. I don't care. Bring somebody with you. That way, if you do have a medical incident, they can call 911, maybe get somebody there in time. Now, if you're at some mountaintop sites, it may not help at all, but it might not be 3 days before you're discovered, at least. And that's a challenge, okay, because everybody's lives are busier. It's not just the engineers. So it's harder. So what do you do in that case? Have a call-out system. How many people wear a smartwatch? How many people have a smartwatch with cardiac monitoring and health reporting? If my heart stops, my watch will buzz, my phone will go off, and it'll call 911. You can program it to do that. So if you have a smartwatch, look to see if it's got that capability. It may be that you've got that extra somebody right there for a situation like this. And again, this isn't going to save everybody in all cases, but it might help some. Okay. The other guy slipped on a piece of conduit, cracked his head against an open cabinet door, and bled out on the site. Had nothing at all to do with medical conditions. Okay, it was just he missed the piece of conduit on the floor. And this is the thing that I get at more and more and more as you do everything, going through your daily life, like I was talking about with that cable ramp in the exhibit hall. Watch for this stuff. Look for the hazards everywhere you go. I cannot tell you how many sites I've walked into with phasers with the front panel off. Well, we need to adjust it every couple of months. Uh-huh. The front panel's part of the circuit in an AM phaser. It's circulating current runs through that. It affects the tuning. Mark would know that better than I do. you can't leave the cover off. And the obvious safety thing, if you happen to trip while you're in front of that phaser, I'm here to tell you 5 kilowatts hurts. 50 kilowatts hurts badly, but for a much shorter period of time. Other challenge, and I've told this story here many times before. If you've heard it before, I don't care, just roll with me. Back in the field service days, I got a call to go work on do an install on a 50 kilowatt in Alberta. So Alberta, Canada is several thousand miles from Halifax, Canada. So you get up early in the morning, you go to the airport, you get on the airplane, you go to Toronto, you wait for a couple hours, you get on another airplane, you fly to Calgary. Guy meets you there, drives you 3 or 4 hours to the transmitter site. So now you're at the transmitter site. You've been up for 14, 15, 16 hours at this point. It's 1 or 2 p.m. because the time changes. Let's start working. So you go through, you run through all the commissioning checks, and I did. I did all, checked all the nuts and bolts, ran through the startup sequence, brought it up into the dummy load. Everything's wonderful. 50 kilowatts, life is grand. And then I'm explaining features. Now at this point, we're getting close to midnight. I'm on the wrong side of 20 hours awake. I'm fueled by caffeine and chocolate-covered Starbucks espresso beans. Oh my God, I love those things. But a half a pound of those things, you're vibrating and you don't have a brain cell active that isn't involved in oscillation. So I'm fueled by adrenaline and caffeine and zero brain matter. And I'm showing them the features. And I say, hey, the cool thing is with this transmitter, it's got dual exciters. And if one fails, it'll auto switch to the other one. So I pull out the crystal on the on-air exciter. That transmitter goes down, 1, 2, 3, flips over, comes right back up. And I said, see, it's really cool. I said, but it's a one-way, one-time thing because the theory is that you got to fix the exciter before it'll go back. So to demonstrate, I pull the crystal out of the standby, which is now the on-air exciter, and it goes down and it stays down. And I said, see, it doesn't try to switch back. And I said, the only way to switch it back is to repair the exciter and then select one of the exciters on the controller. So I hit the exciter button just as I realize, oh, I forgot to plug the crystal in. So I reach up and plug the crystal in. I don't know what frequency a crystal first comes up at, but I can assure you it's not the carrier frequency. That transmitter made a sound like a frozen cat going through a bandsaw. And smoke and components come raining out the front. And I said, oh, I guess this is where we learn module repair. So we started fixing amplifiers. When we ran out of parts, it was 6 a.m. I'd been awake well over 24 hours. And we called it. And I went back to the hotel. Long story short, I had to call the company. We got a bunch of parts and modules shipped out. Total cost to the company, over $20,000, because I was too stupid to stop work when I hit the point where I shouldn't have been working anymore. Now, as you get older, you start to recognize that. You get that little dizzy feeling, and it's like, okay, I'm done. And, you know, who was it? Used to be, forget who said it. I want to credit Steve Church with it, but somebody somewhere said nobody ever died from a lack of rock and roll. But a lot of people have died from trying to work on getting the rock and roll back on when they were too tired to do so. Okay, so that's the kind of thing you need to keep in the back of your mind. Bringing it a little local, this is Kent Weinrich in the WISN phaser room in Milwaukee. Hey, that picture goes back more than a year or two because Kent's got hair and it's not white. But when you're working in a room like this, you need to pay attention. Now, what's between Kent and the camera person on the floor? A trip and fall hazard. That's why I leave that picture in there. Kent thinks I do it because we're good buddies, and we are. But the picture is there because that broomstick should not be laying on that floor like that in a 50 kilowatt phaser room. Now, obviously, I would hope, and I've never asked them, but I would hope that the phaser was actually powered down. I wouldn't stand in that room when it was running, I don't think. But again, look for the hazards everywhere you go. If you do that, odds are a lot higher that you get to walk home without an injury. There's also a legal aspect to all of this. How many people in here actually went to school for broadcast engineering? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. How many people are in the room? 50, 60? Is anybody keeping attendance here? OSHA flat out says if you're not trained for the job you do, you're not legally supposed to be doing it. How do we get trained for the job we do in this industry? You get trained by doing it and not dying in the process. You know, the survivors. We're the survivors, folks. Let's keep that rolling. Now think about that for a second, though. That is quite true. You know, Darwin's Law applies in broadcast as well as anything. It's just when we employ it, it involves a lot more smoke and noise. But this is something that, legally speaking, if you do something foolish, it's going to impact a lot of folks beyond your immediate family. Okay, and that's just something to keep in the back of your mind too. And again, I'm not telling people to be scared of the transmitter, because being afraid of the transmitter is even worse than being lackadaisical almost. Be cautious, be respectful. You know, it's like Alex Hartman likes to say, the transmitter is trying to kill you. I mean, but it's not sentient about it. It's not actively trying to kill you. It's just capable of killing you. Okay? So we do have costs associated with having fewer engineers. Because there are fewer of us, you run the risk of more off-air time. Okay? Higher cost of repairs, et cetera, and so on, because a lot of times you got to farm that stuff out. So, and increased time to cause repairs because dumb people are working way beyond the time frame when they should be working. So pay attention to those things. Okay. Beyond that, how many people have heard me talk about static protective footwear before, or not static protective, shock resistant? How many people actually own shock resistant footwear? Yay, hands, I'm seeing hands. First time I did this presentation, no hands went up, so we've already made an improvement. You can get, and here it's called EH, electrohazard rated, and if you search electric hazard or electrohazard on walmart.com, you'll get several pair of $100 to $150 sneakers, footwear that's shock resistant. Now shock resistant footwear, if you put 10,000 volts across it will only pass a milli, or maybe it's 18,000. It's there, 18,000 will only pass a milliamp of current. Okay, so it's a pretty high resistance. When you do something foolish, shock resistant footwear can help keep you alive. I'll give you an example. Standing on an oil rig in the Persian Gulf, because that's where I spend all my fun days, and we just finished installing a navigational beacon. So it's only a 50 watt beacon running into a whip antenna. But 50 watts at 190 kilohertz kicks out a pretty good RF waveform. And the funny thing about oil rigs, they put them in salt water. And salt water and metal tend to have a bad relationship. There's a lot of oxidation occurring. So oil rigs are constantly being painted. So there's scaffolding bolted to the rig deck. And I'm leaning against the scaffold and talking to the engineer, standing 15 feet away from this whip antenna radiating 190 kilohertz. And I'm not thinking anything out of it. He comes over, he leans against it and jumps back with a burn down the length of his arm. I'm wearing shock resistant footwear, he's wearing sneakers. That's the difference. They can, when you do something foolish, save your life. Now, all the normal rules apply, one hand behind your back and take off the metal jewelry. Again, the common sense stuff that we all pretty much know. But if you happen to lean against the rack with shock-resistant footwear on, with one foot on the copper strap and lightning hits the tower, odds are you'll have a much happier day than if you don't. Okay? Everybody knows what this is. I mentioned it earlier. If you have a tube transmitter or an AM transmitter especially, you need one of those. Now, most of them come equipped. Check them on occasion. Some transmitters, the grounding wand uses a bleeder resistor. Those bleeder resistors have an annoying habit of being open circuit. Okay, it's like the bleeder resistors in the power supply of a 317. Sometimes they're open circuit. You shut the thing off and you reach in because, hey, the bleeder resistor's supposed to take the voltage down. one of the presidents, Trust But Verify? I forget who that was. But yeah, always, always, always use the ground stick. If you don't have one, a wooden broomstick, a roll of duct tape, and a pair of jumper cables. Now you do have one. It's the easiest thing in the world to make. Here's the other thing to think about. If you're working on an AM rig, antennas receive as well as they transmit, actually sometimes better, depending on the situation. I had a customer in Paraguay, and he was working, he had one of our 100 kilowatt transmitters, and those ones are equipped with internal grounding circuits. So you shut the transmitter off, it's keyed interlocks, you take out the key, you go to the mains, you shut down the AC breaker, you take the key out of there, then you can ground the output of the transmitter, then you can get all the keys for the cabinets and everything to do what you need to do. But you got to go through that process. You got to ground the output of the transmitter. So he did. Then he goes out to the ATU, which coincidentally is about a quarter wavelength away, 300 feet, give or take, leans against the tower, and comes out with severe second and three. He lost a hand and a couple of fingers, I don't know, but he lost part of his hand. Turns out his transmitter was off. The 200 kilowatt a mile away was not off. Okay? Antennas receive as well as they transmit. Remember that. Ground, not enough to ground the output of the transmitter. If you're working in the ATU, you ground the base of the tower. Always, always, always. Even if you're just taking a pair of, again, battery jumper booster cables, best thing ever. Just slam them across the ball gaps. Okay. Now, step number two, and I discovered this the hard way once, make sure that the base of the tower does actually have a ground rod connected to it. Because a surprising number of them do not. You can tell if you've got a 50 kilowatt on 880 and the signal doesn't go more than 2 or 3 miles, your ground system is probably gone and it's just radiating straight to the space, which give you a great signal on the moon, but not so much in Memphis in this case. So ground system, yeah, verify that. It's all part of a system. Okay, RF goes out, the antenna comes back on the ground for AM. This is less about safety, but not really. How many people have an infrared camera of some sort? Whether it's the FLIR I've got shown here, or whether it's the little fluke point and shoot laser cameras, or any of the other ones. There's so many of them available and they're cheap. I've made it a habit, I carry one in my laptop case, and every site I go to, I take a picture of the breaker panel. And so far my record's 196 degrees Fahrenheit. And at one of these shows one day, Stu, I think it was when we were in Oshkosh in June. Fond du Lac, they're right next door. But yeah, somebody showed me a picture, they had measured 215 degrees Fahrenheit on a circuit breaker. Circuit breakers ideally are not supposed to run that warm. Typically, that's a bad sign. It's a good chance for a site fire, okay? So it's a maintenance note more than a safety note, but it's a useful tip. And this is something else to pay attention to. How many people have arc flash training in here? Couple? Cool. So the big takeaway on this is 125 kVA. Voltage times current is kVA. So, as an example, if we're running on 200, and I'm going to use 200 volts because that's easy math, and it's more than 600 amps on the entrance, you're into arc flash territory easily. If you're running 480, 300 amps. Okay, if you've got a 50 kilowatt AM running on 240, and we do build them, you're into arc flash territory. Okay, 40 kilowatt FM on 240, especially single phase. Okay, and I know there's one of those in your neck of the woods, John. Not quite, it's down in Wasilla, but in that ballpark, because Paul put one in for 40 kilowatt on single phase. I know it because I sold it. So anyway, arc flash territory. Arc flash is not something I am going to try to even pretend to teach in the 15 minutes and 20 some odd seconds we've got left. But it is something that you absolutely need to be aware of, because that is scary, scary stuff. And it requires very specific PPE, and it is very, very clearly covered under OSHA regulations. So when you're out at the site someday, take a look at the entrance, your service entrance, figure out what the current rating is on the service entrance, multiply that by the voltage of the entrance, and figure out if you need to put into the boss and say, we need this training. Because theoretically, if your main breaker is into arc flash territory, unless you have that PPP on and the training, certified training in place, you're not legally allowed to throw that breaker. Okay, just something to be aware of. So this picture, Tim will recognize this picture, I saw him back here somewhere, is courtesy of, rest his soul, Mike McCarthy. It's from down in Chicago. It's lockout tagouts. And I chuckled when he showed me the picture, and he goes, yeah, I know what's wrong with the picture. So somebody tell me, what's wrong with the picture? Right. Now, Mike, and Mike made a really good point with it. And he used lockout tagouts pretty religiously, right, Tim? And he said that the best thing about the lockouts, he goes, isn't that it keeps anybody else from turning the breaker on, because I'm usually the only one there. The lockouts are to make me slow down and think. Did I restore the interlock? Did I put those protective panels back? Did I pick up the hazards on the floor? Things like that. Okay, so I'll probably use that picture for as long as I'm still working, just because Mike and I work together a lot of times, and I like that picture. So, like I said, lockouts do work if you've got a bunch of people on the site. They'll keep somebody from turning it on while your elbow's deep in phaser. All right, I mean, transmitter interlocks, this is something else. How many people have walked into a site where a transmitter had the airflow interlock bypassed? Tube rig. More than a hand or two. How many people have walked into the site where the back door interlocks on a SX transmitter were bypassed? Because, you know, the paperclip, because the only way to wire the remote control was to open the back door and lean in there at about waist height and get in to hook it up. All right, I mean, I've walked into more of our 50 kilowatt sites with the plunger interlocks or the old AmFET series marks, like the one you had at WWI, where the back panel would be off and that little plunger interlock would be bypassed. Do not leave interlocks bypassed. How many people are familiar with radio station temporary? It's a thing, people. There's a lot of times you're like, I got to get it back on the air. Airflow interlock is doing something flaky. Throw that paper clip in there to hold it up. And 10 years later, it's still like that when the blower motor fails and the plate, their tube socket melts itself down into the power supply. All right, don't bypass interlocks unless you absolutely have to, and typically not unless the manufacturer recommends it. There are times on our 50 kilowatt AMs, the big ones, everything is interlocked in the power supply. And there are times where you will have to bypass an interlock. And we'll tell you, bypass the interlock, kill the mains, clip the meters in place, restore the mains, read the meter, kill the mains, pull the meter, restore the interlock, put the panel back on, turn the mains on. It's a process. It adds time, absolutely, at a time when we're all stretched thin. But, you know, how much time is it going to take if you happen to burn a finger off or two? So pay attention. And I mentioned earlier, trust but verify. Now, that goes two ways. So number one, absolutely, I love these contact type voltage sensors. But if you buy especially the cheap ones on Amazon, make sure on a known hot circuit that they still work. Turns out batteries go dead, and on some of them they don't have a fail-safe to tell you the battery's dead. So you can go in there with your little contact voltage meter, touch it, nope, that circuit's down, and discover, oh no, it isn't. Okay. Every time, how many people have had a three-phase breaker with one pole weld short? So you turn the breaker off and reach in and it just, ouch. Trust but verify. Okay, if you shut off a three-phase breaker, on the other end, measure all three phases before you go sticking your fingers in there. All right, these are the kind of things that, like I say, it's easy to forget. I'm here to tell you, though, you only forget this stuff once. The challenge is whether you get a chance to forget it a second time. Again, wall of text, I'm not going to bother reading it. But how many people, now different folks are sensitive to different voltage levels. Like I'll wire a 120-volt circuit in my house hot. And if I do happen to get across it, it's like, huh, whoops. My oldest boy, who is an electrician, he hits 125 volts and he notices. It makes him jump badly. Okay, now for me, that starts somewhere above 240. 240, I'll notice it and say, oh, that probably shouldn't have touched that. But I don't know. I tend to be a little less, maybe I'm not hydrated enough or something. But, you know, now having said that, I'm not going to lick my fingers and put them across the 240-volt circuit just to see. But yeah, again, this is not something you want to test on a 480-volt power supply. Wonder what my overall body resistance is. Again, you only make some of these mistakes once. Okay, I mentioned earlier physical safety. I talked about the broomstick on the floor back in Kent's picture. It's amazing how many sites I walk into, and I don't know if I've got the picture in there, but we'll assume I probably do at some point. We'll work like I do, and if I don't, I'll just tell you the story in a couple of seconds. It's amazing how many sites I walk into where there are trip and fall hazards all over the place. Now this one, they went to extreme. He's got the ladder bungee corded to the wall, which is cool because now you don't have to lean it so it can go up tighter so it's even a little more room. But just secure things. By the way, cool reference. Somebody sent me a note about this. If you work with electrical stuff at all, which we pretty much all do, that book is a really good resource. I don't remember who sent it to me, but you'll notice that I got it from the SBE bookstore. Just as a side note to the SBE members in the room. Okay, we talked about temperature. I mentioned protective panels before. There's a bunch of reasons to leave them in place. Say in AM circuits, the cover, the aluminum cover on a filter or a phaser is part of the circuit. The circulating currents, if you're watching on a spectrum analyzer or on a distortion meter, you can see the readings change as you remove or install the cover. And Mark would know this, again, better than I do. But put the covers in place. They're either there for safety, they're there for airflow, or they're there because they're part of the circuit. Doesn't matter why they're there for a reason. Has anybody heard me talk about grounding before? Anybody heard me mention what I think about compression connections? I don't like compression connections. Anytime you have copper in a connector, it can work loose because copper is malleable. It will deform to displace air in the connector, and then it's a loose connection. If you have a compression connection, if you've got a stranded wire going into something that screws down, come back a week later and tighten it down again. Come back a month later, tighten it down again. Come back a year later, tighten it down again. Then you can probably walk away. Or you could just CAD weld it and forget about it, but that's a whole different discussion. You can't do that on a power supply. Okay, there's the obvious physical security. I mean, this one, obviously, it's hard to tell who's sneaking up on you in a situation like this. But beyond that, under that peeled back section of the roof, wonder if I can get the laser pointer to work way over there. I can't even see it. But under that peeled off section of the roof, there's $160,000 worth of broadcast transmitter covered with a tarp. I know nobody in here has ever seen a transmitter under a tarp before. Except this one was like that 3 years later when I came back. Okay, so physical safety is again something, and more sites, how many people have had copper theft at a site? More than a few. Those drain pipes you're looking at there are containing the ground strap and the cables going out to a three-tower directional AM array. That was their solution. if it's less visible. One of the things I tell folks, roofing tar is your friend. Paint the strap with roofing tar. Number one, it makes it less visible. Shiny stuff is what gets stolen first. Number two, it kills the resale value because you can't get roofing tar off a copper strap. And most meth heads know that. Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. Scott said he's seen hardline and coax painted white to make it look more like PVC and less like coax. So that's a really good point. Okay, secure the entrance. Decent locks. Again, this isn't going to deter a highly determined crackhead. And most of them seem to be pretty focused on getting whatever they need. I've seen a $10,000 air conditioner scrapped for a $20 copper coil. Okay, but basics. This site, by the way, these pictures are all taken from the same site in Washington, Port Everett, Washington, just north of Seattle. You may remember about 15, 20 years ago now, this guy, Andy Scottdoll, was building an AM site in a wetland. He had all the EPA protections, gone through all the hoops and hurdles. Earth First, one of the environmental groups, I'm being politically correct for a change. It's early, I haven't had enough coffee to be me yet. But they knocked down two of his towers with a bulldozer. Now think about this, what level of brain activity do you need to take a Cat D8 and push down a tower with it? Towers typically don't just fall away from the thing knocking them down at ground level. It turns out one of them didn't. It landed on the bulldozer, and they didn't find any bodies, so apparently the lunatic got away. But yeah, so when he built that site, it was hardened beyond all belief. I mean, razor wire, anti-climb fencing, and all the hidden copper. And cameras. Okay. IT security, I'm not going to touch that. You got a bunch of people smarter than me talking about IT security, so we'll just skip right past that. But challenges, we are doing more with less. We're getting older. We're working longer hours. How many people work an eight-hour day in here and no longer? One or two? Only an eight-hour day, 40-hour week. You know, on a good day, I suspect most of us are probably into the 60-hour week, easily. Some probably a little more. The challenge gets when you're working on a project to not let yourself get so immersed in the project that you start working at the point. And like I say, I call it vibration sensor. When I start to feel that tingly, vibrating feeling, that means I am functioning on, I've got more caffeine in my blood system than blood at that point, and it's time to back off and find a hotel. Now, ideally, you'll learn when that feeling is approaching so you can say things and back out and get it to a safe point, but just pay attention to that stuff. All right, mandatory PR stuff. That's as close as you'll ever hear me get to a sales pitch because I suck at them. 1 minute and 20 seconds left. We can handle one or two questions if anybody wants to run around with the mic. Anybody got a question, comment, thought? Or did I just terrorize you all early in the morning?
I just wanted to comment on the one picture you had of Kent in the phaser room, which was my phaser room before him.
Yes.
That's where we stored the paper towels and toilet paper because it was a safe place. We knew it wasn't going to radiate in there. But I also used that as a demonstration room to take a 4-foot fluorescent light bulb fixture and have my guests who would show up, you know, do maintenance on the generator or things of that, and said, here, watch this, turn the lights off, and here's Darth Vader.
Yep.
And used to have fun on there.
I've walked under a 100-foot elevated counter, or a 100-kilowatt elevated counterpoise site in Brazil holding a 4-foot fluorescent, and it's lit as brightly as if it was in a fixture. All right, we're down to 20 seconds. Shane, going to make John, oh, nope, here comes Ken. It's really scary that I've been here long enough that I could pick most of you out by name. That's awesome.
So the irony is in certain large corporate organizations, they don't want you, they won't give you another guy, but they don't want you bringing just anybody out to the site because, quote, it's a liability.
Right.
How do you deal with that?
So that's where you come back to, you either in a situation like that, you either need to have them schedule the assistant with you, or worst case scenario, and I mean, it's a double-edged sword. Like the cool thing in Canada, our workforce rules say that you have right to refuse unsafe work. You theoretically have that down here, but then you can get fired for it and have to fight it out in court anyway. So it's really a risk factor. And that's where a lot of times, well, one of the things you do, set up a webcam and have somebody remotely watching you, as an example. So there are options, but absolutely, you're right. We have to get more creative about our safety sometimes. All right. Thanks very much, folks. Have a wonderful day.